Jesus.
Yellow light!
I'm walking here! I'm walking!
Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH. We are streaming on the KTTH smartphone app, where if you fire up that app right now, you'll not only be able just to listen to the show, but you can actually watch the show on our live studio cam. We finally got it up and running, and it's available on the KTTH app or KTTH.com. Seattle police staffing is in the toilet, and it's going to affect every single person who is listening to my voice right this moment. And it's What's Trending.
What's Trending? A Jason Rant exclusive.
The Seattle Police Department has staffing that is way worse than what local leaders have admitted to us in the past. And the staffing crisis explains, at least in part, the crime issues that are plaguing the city of Seattle, whether we're talking about violent crime, juvenile crime, property crime, whatever it is. You can pretty much pinpoint all of the reasons why we're seeing something still explode all across Seattle. The department hasn't seen such low levels of staff, they said, since the 1990s, but I found out since at least 1957. Now, I'm going to throw some numbers out at you. And usually when you do a whole bunch of numbers, it's very boring. I will try to make it less boring. But these are important numbers because it provides you the context of the situation where I say it's at emergency levels and you hear others like Seattle Police Officer Guild President Officer Mike Solon talk about the crisis. It's so you actually understand the context and how truly awful it is. The department has only 437 police officers assigned to patrol. Now, there's a little bit of an asterisk there, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But 437 police officers assigned to patrol, that according to human resources documents that I obtained. Now, obviously, 437, they're not all working at the same time. If that were the case, we probably would be considered over-policed. That's 437 cops across all three shifts, across all five precincts. 24/7. Only 437. Now, to give you some perspective of what that actually means, because you might be saying, well, how many do you normally have? Let's look specifically at the North Precinct and their third watch, so the overnight shift. They used to have about 30 or so cops every single shift. They're now routinely at 13. So they went from 30 to 13. They are almost always at or below minimum staffing or staffing minimums. What does that mean? The minimum amount of staff you need to keep yourself and the community safe. They are sometimes meeting that minimum. Oftentimes, they are below it, which means they have to call over to other precincts for assistance. Except there's a problem. When you call those other precincts, you realize, oh, they are also at or below staffing minimums. That's not good. And what this ends up meaning, because you'll hear oftentimes, and we talk about this as well, deployable staff doesn't necessarily mean all the people who are within the Seattle Police Department, but it's everyone who can, if need be, go out into the field with a uniform and police. The problem, however, is when you have so few cops at any given time in Seattle, you can see very quickly how vulnerable this city could be. If, God forbid, and let's just go into the extreme, unlikely but possible, there's a terrorist attack. Okay, if that's the case, you understand that not only would we not be able as a city to immediately address it, you would then need King County Sheriff's Office, you would need the Bellevue PD, you would need the Washington State Patrol, you would need Everett PD, you would need a whole bunch of people just to do some of the basics. Just the basics. And if, God forbid, there were two large criminal issues at once, and you'll recall, we've had a few mass shootings, we've had a few high-speed chases following a shooting that has basically taken everyone from the city, taking their focus away from what it is that they're doing to focus on this one crime. If that were to happen again, just one big crime that takes everyone's attention, the entire city is vulnerable to a second crime that could be big or small. You're not going to have anyone realistically able to respond to 911 calls. And just because an officer is listed as quote-unquote patrol doesn't even necessarily mean that they're regularly working patrol, that they're actually responding to 911 calls. And here's another example. You have four patrol officers assigned to communications administration. So, in other words, they're not responding to 911 calls, they're handling comms. Now, that doesn't mean they might not end up responding to a 911 call in cases of emergencies, but as part of just their regular duties, they're not out on patrol. So you've got 437 police officers on patrol. The caveat being the numbers that we have come from October 31st of 2023. Why? Because when you put in a public disclosure request with SPD, it takes 5, 6, 7, 8 months, sometimes over a year before they turn everything over. So I expect to have even more updated numbers, but I've spoken to multiple people, including the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, who says my October numbers are almost the same as what they are right now in April or what they were at the end of March. Give or take, there's going to be some differences. Part of that is because there's something called the HR unavailable list. What is that? It means someone who is out on extended leave. They can come back at any given time, and obviously we don't have those numbers. I can tell you, though, right now, there's 56 officers who are listed on the HR unavailable list, at least as of the end of March. 56. Some of them, many of them coming from patrol. But there's something that is incredibly concerning. The police force is getting old. Like, pretty old. Just of the patrol officers, the 437, of those 437 officers, at least 66 are right this moment eligible for retirement. They could all retire tomorrow if they wanted to. And 84 of the 437 are over the age of 50. Now, I've been focusing on patrol because when we talk about the crime crisis, that's usually what it is that we're concerned with, that if you call 911, you don't necessarily get someone responding as quickly as you would need them to. And in fact, depending on when it is you call and what it is you're calling about, it might take hours or you might not get someone responding, depending on what it is. But no matter how you look at the data, let's not even just look at patrol. No matter how you parse out this data, it's really bad. And the hiring is not even coming close to keeping up with these separations. You have, according to the SPD, they acknowledge this number, 913 total deployable officers. And remember, that is just someone who technically can put on the uniform and respond. So that means we're also including Chief Adrian Diaz. We're including all the folks who work on the administrative side, but still can technically put on that uniform and go into the field. That's what we're talking about here. Now, the SPD has said many times that this is as bad as it's been since at least 2009. That's what they say. It's actually way worse. They're not hiding this. They just didn't find the document that I got a hold of. Because I got a hold of a staffing document from 1958, believe it or not. And on that staffing document, it gave the final numbers for the total of 1957. And so on December 31st, 1957, the total number of officers was 925. Now, quick pop quiz, Producer Jackson. Can you tell me what has happened to the population since 1957?
I think it's gone up.
It's exploded, hasn't it? Yeah. Kind of like significantly, probably.
Yeah, I would think so.
Just a guess. We don't even have to check Wikipedia. I think we can make that as a reasonable guess. It's kind of gotten a lot larger. And yet we have fewer cops today than we had on December 31st, 1957. That is absolutely insane. That is absolutely insane. Now, again, just giving you some context, before COVID hit, the staffing desire for the city, for in total, all-inclusive, was between $1,500 and $1,600. They revised that down after the exodus during the BLM riots and rallies to about $1,400. Okay? The goal was by 2025 to get back to that $1,400 goal number. It is not going to happen. This is not going to happen for decades. That's how bad the situation is. And that means, of course, 911 calls aren't getting responded to. It means that cops are suffering from greater burnout. It means that they're looking at the caseload that they're dealing with. They're like, oh my God, how are we supposed to do it? It's becoming untenable. Now, outside of patrol, you can look at the individual units that you would hope would be fully staffed. Property crime, kind of a big deal. Burglaries, kind of a big deal. Larceny, theft, all have gone up. When you specifically look at motor vehicle theft, 2023, it hit 9,175. That is the highest number we've seen since 2008, which was the last time, or the latest, that it was updated. That's the last publicly available data point, 2008. What else has gone up? Juvenile crime? Through the roof. We've seen a surge of juvenile crime. And again, it's not just about, you know, graffiti or maybe stealing a candy bar from the... Can we find a Bartell that's still open? Let's go switch to Walgreens. I need a new example. That's not what we're talking about anymore. Now we're talking about armed carjackings. And yet, looking at the units, there are only 13 total sworn police officers plus two sergeants covering burglary, theft, and juvenile. Now, I have to assume that those two departments were put into one before this huge crime crisis, this huge surge, where pretty much what you could assume was happening with juveniles is that it was probably related to theft or burglary, generally speaking. There were some one-offs, of course, but now that's no longer the case, and yet you still only have 13 sworn officers to that unit. You have only 9 assigned to just general investigations. You have only 1 in the auto theft department. 1. You have an increase in bias incidents that end up getting reported, suspected hate crimes. We've seen a surge of that as well. 1 cop, 1 detective there. That's it. And even though these numbers are horrific right now and terrifying right now, they could be so much worse. Oh my God, they could be so much worse tomorrow. Because when I look at the entire SPD, all inclusive, we're talking about the specialty officers, the ones on the HR unavailable list because they're on an extended vacation or they were injured, whatever it is. All inclusive, right this moment, there are 280 officers eligible to retire based on either age or tenure. They could retire tomorrow. And if you lose 280 cops tomorrow, we no longer have a functioning police department. We no longer have a functioning police department, not in a city like Seattle. If even a fraction of the 280 decide to retire this year, and we know obviously that some of them are going to retire, we would be struggling even more to function, especially given the fact that new hires are just not coming in. And by the way, another story I'm working on, those new hires that they've been celebrating, lots of them have already left, either getting fired or deciding, I can't do this. That's how bad it is. And when you take a deeper dive into the numbers, understand, on the one hand, you can say, okay, it's an older police force, that's not great from a patrol perspective. I mean, are you going to be able to chase down the bad guy? Don't worry, we banned chases in Seattle even after the initiative. But the other side of the coin is that, well, those are people who have a lot of experience, like a ton of institutional knowledge. They know the streets. They have community relationships. They know how to handle some of the worst crime because they've experienced it as police officers. Well, if they leave, who then steps into that position as the one who really knows how to work within a bureaucracy, who really knows what to do in certain circumstances that maybe you have to think outside of the box? The average age of staff right now available for retirement is 55. The oldest officer is 72 years old. 72 years old in the burglary, theft, and juvenile department. Again, going to go out on a limb and say he's not chasing down bad guys on the streets. Because you can break a hip. God bless him. It's 72 working. If I'm working at 72, something really went wrong. Something went wrong. At least in my career.
Hopefully I'm not I mean,
if you're here when I'm 72, your life is worse than mine.
Oh, for sure.
I'm just throwing that out there. I don't expect you to be with me for the rest of your career. I don't want that. 70, that's too much.
Neither do I.
That's just too much. Hey, you know, relax. You just started. You're supposed to be, oh, I can't believe I'm on the show. But like 72 years old, God bless him for actually working. And here's the thing. We need him to work. We need that 72-year-old to work. Now, the question then becomes, well, when does this all end? When do things start to go in the right direction? And the truth is, the answer is, I don't know. No one knows. There's some assumptions you can make. We told you yesterday that over the weekend, there was a tentative agreement on a new contract. They're having info sessions today. They had a couple yesterday. They have one on Thursday. All the members of SPOG, Seattle Police Officers Guild, they go into a meeting room and they find out what's in the contract. Then they vote. Now, let's just assume for the sake of the argument that they love the contract. It's amazing. And it gets passed. Then it goes to the council. They debate it. And let's just assume for the sake of argument, they're all like, thumbs up. We love it. Hashtag refund cops. They've just taken a completely different approach. Even then, you can expect that you'll get a nice little bump in people maybe finally wanting to work for the department. You're going to see a lot of the angry activists, because I don't think people realize, and when you don't work for 3 years, perhaps you should assume this, you do realize that they're going to have to pay, the city's going to pay back pay to every single officer. Every single officer, they're going to get huge checks. So it doesn't really make sense from just a business perspective that they go without a contract for 3 years, but the city dragged its feet. They were dealing at the time with a council that loathed cops. They loathed them. That was the Shamasa. You think you're going to be able to negotiate with Shamasawant? But now it's a little bit different. But you're going to have to do huge back pay. It's going to upset a lot of activists. And then you're going to have people who maybe would say, oh, with a contract, I'm more interested in working, saying, it's still Seattle. Look at these lunatics. How long does it take to change the culture around policing? I don't know. But every time I talk to the president of the guild, he says it's going to take decades. Decades to fix. Just think about that for a second. And you might be saying to yourself, well, I don't live in Seattle. How does this impact me? Well, do you ever visit Seattle? Ever? Do you ever go to a Mariners game? Do you ever go to the Paramount Theater? Do you ever come into town for like a specialty doctor's appointment? Do you ever have to come here? Well, then yes, it impacts you. But as importantly, and we say this on the show all the time, what happens in Seattle doesn't stay here. This is not Las Vegas. So when you have a crime surge or a police staffing crisis, it ends up impacting other communities. Now, we'll also say a positive on how it affects you. Let's say you live in Pierce County and Sheriff Ed Troyer's been trying to hire, Thurston County Sheriff Derek Sanders been trying to hire and have been making some significant hires. Well, guess what? They're taking a lot of the Seattle cops because they don't want to work in Seattle anymore, but they still want to stay in policing. Not all of them leave town. Not all of them leave the state. A lot of them do, but not all of them. Some go to Spokane, some go to Everett, some go to Bellevue, some go to Pierce County. That's obviously good news from your perspective. But again, it's going to inspire another rise, a surge in crime in Seattle. And that does no one any favors. Not individuals who live here, work here, visit. This is just bad news across the board. Now, I'll have all the numbers up at KTTH.com. I did give the SPD until 4 o'clock to give me any updated numbers that maybe let them look a little bit better than they do right now. We're not expecting a ton of changes. And unless they double pretty much every number I just gave to you, which we know they're not going to do, we're at an emergency level here. And there's no sign yet that it's going to get better. So you can find out that story at 6 o'clock. It'll be live at ktth.com. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Bad guy alert.
So more controversy over at Green Hill School. This is the youth detention facility in Chehalis. It's been coming under constant scrutiny because, frankly, it fails kids. You put kids who are in desperate need of course correction. I mean, if you're getting to a juvenile detention facility in Washington State, understand we're dealing with the worst of the worst of the worst. Now, some of them, let's just be totally upfront. People don't say this often enough. Some of them cannot be saved. It's true. But some of them can. Some of the worst of the worst of the worst actually can be saved. But when you fail them, you guarantee that you're not even, they're not even going to have a shot at course correction. And Green Hill School has failed these kids over and over and over again. We have had so many scandals out of the Green Hill School. One of them was with an employee, Michelle Goodman. And she, according to Fox 13, is embroiled in yet another potential scandal. Now, she has already been booked on multiple charges, including conspiracy to incite a riot. This is an employee of the Green Hill School. They say that employee was captured on surveillance footage laughing about a teen who ended up getting beat up while she was on watch as a guard. And detectives say, according to Fox 13, she facilitated the attack against this teenager. So talk about failing these kids. Fox writes, according to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, they didn't learn about the incident until January 16th, more than 2 weeks after the incident took place. However, a doctor noticed bruising more than a week prior on the kid, the teen victim. A DCYF spokesperson told Fox 13 that they did not refer the incident to law enforcement because it did not rise to the level of law enforcement referral. What in God's name do you have to do to get it to that point? Stab the kid? Are we waiting for, not even that. They have to bring a gun into? Okay, got it. They say, a former nurse that worked with the injured inmate called the injuries obvious, noting he had yellow discolored bruising. He even described to investigators that had a psychiatrist not stepped in to move the inmate following the fight, quote, he would have been killed if he remained in that wing. Now, this is all coming from notes that came from one of the medical checkups that was discovered in this lawsuit, part of the court documents that Fox 13 got a hold of. Now, we've been talking about this for a while because you've got the governor basically ignoring all the issues. You have law enforcement task forces saying, could you please let us do our jobs and do an investigation, being stymied each and every step of the way. Well, now finally, he's come out within the last few weeks because, at some point he's going to have to say something to say, okay, maybe there are some problems, but don't worry. Even though we told you last time we were going to figure it out and then clearly failed, we're going to figure it out this time because, third time's a charm.
Well, we need to make more changes at Green Hill. We have now put 23, 24, and 25-year-olds in the same place with young kids. We've never done this before. This is creating new challenges in security, and I think you're going to see a discussion of that in the months to come.
Not to be a stickler here, but could you have had that discussion before you made the decision to put 24 and 25-year-olds with 16-year-olds? Knowing they're all bad kids, maybe you could have had that conversation before you made this decision. Not that you care, because the whole goal from Democrats is to remove people from jail. Remember, no youth jail. That is the Democrat movement. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. You've been listening to What's Trending, brought to you by Legacy Group Capital Northwest Fund. When we come back, oh, God. Am I going to just give me an aneurysm today? Is that the goal here?
I mean, it'd be kind of entertaining.
I mean, you can just be honest and say, yes, we're trying to make sure you explode, because when we come back, Seattle School District decided to take the next step in ditching the gifted program because they had too many white kids. Oh, my God. It's the Jason Rancho. To the Jason Rancho. Thank you so much for tuning in. You had a whole bunch of privileged progressives putting on their white knight armor in the Seattle School District saying, we're moving to the next part of our plan to get rid of all of the gifted programs, the classes, the schools. Now, I feel like they called it the highly capable cohort program because that sounded really pretentious. Just call it the gifted. Oh, we can't say gifted. You know, they're highly capable. Well, if calling someone gifted is offensive to the people who aren't gifted, wouldn't the implication being you're calling everyone else highly incapable?
I mean, I wasn't gifted and I'm not offended. So.
I just say it's just one of the why I feel like it's one of those things. And I'm not even saying that's why they chose to call it this. I think they just like doing things that sound way more intense than they are. It's just a gifted program. It's kids who are smarter than the others generally, or they're learning faster, and they get bored if they're in the traditional course. And rather than hold them back. You put them in a place where they can excel and not be bored. And then ultimately, weirdly enough, end up doing poorly in school. When you're not challenged, even though you're smart, you may end up doing poorly. And so they moved him into this program. However, back in 2018, they decided, well, actually, the highly capable cohorts, let's just call them the highly capable white supremacists, because they're too white. They're too white. They're too Asian as well. But Asians and whites are the same to the radical left. They make no difference whatsoever between Asian people and white people. Why? Because it's hard to say that something is racist when the overperformers are Asian. And so because they have good scores, they say, oh, let's just put them in with the white kids. We've had school districts like the North Thurston School District quite literally do that in their stats. It's actually kind of amazing. But in this case, they looked at the numbers and they said, ugh, this is not good. And so they decided back in 2018 to phase out the entire program. The entire program. The critics said, this is not a reflection of the diversity of our community. And oddly enough, this was in fact inspired by the BLM movement, but the old school BLM movement before George Floyd. Because again, this was pre-2018. And this was in 2018 when they made this decision. 3 years after the district hired an equity specialist, again, all this nonsense was happening way before BLM truly took a foothold in this country and no one really paid attention. But at the time, they got this equity specialist to try to figure out, well, why are the numbers the way that they are? And they looked at the time, the demographics of the highly capable cohort. And they said it served 13% multiracial students, 11.8% Asian, 3.7% Hispanic, and 1.6% Black. Now, by the way, by last year, because it's still technically going, they're just phasing it out, and it'll be phased out completely by 2027, 2028. The numbers were 20% multiracial. So that's a 7% improvement. They were 16% Asian, so about 5%, 4% more. 8.2% Hispanic, which is about 4-ish percent more, and 3.4% Black, almost double where it was before. But it didn't match the district's diversity, meaning you've got 15% Black students in SPS. The assumption, they believe, is that you'll get 15% Black students labeled as gifted. They weren't happy. They said, yeah, we're gone. Black parents who had kids in the program, they spoke up. I went back and I looked at some of the video from the 2018 meetings and before that. They were saying, can you not do this? Because we've got kids. I mean, you say you're doing this for communities of color. That's us. Can you maybe not hurt our kids? They were called by, at the time, the director of the Seattle Public School Director, or excuse me, Public Directors. They were called by Chandra Hampson tokens. That they were tokenized by white parents. Because that's definitely not racist, telling a Black parent that the only reason why they care about their kid is because they've been manipulated into doing so by a white parent. Oh, it's totally not racist at all. Please continue with your land acknowledgement. Because you're definitely not woke enough at all. So what are they doing now? This is the goal. They're going to replace the gifted program and implement in each classroom in the district, something called the whole classroom model. The whole classroom model. It's going to start right now and then get expanded in the 2024-2025 school year. There's no way this thing works. It doesn't make any sense. This is how the model will work. Classrooms will get students of all different learning abilities by design. So they'll say, hey, it depends on how many gifted kids they have. We'll put 30% gifted kids in this class. We'll put 60, 70% or 65% the normies. We'll call them the normies, the dum-dums, the normies. And then we'll put like 5% of kids who have special education needs. We'll put them all in one class. Now, teachers right now are complaining that they have too many kids in their class. And what we've decided to do then is put all different learning abilities, ensuring that none of them truly get served. And it was interesting because the Seattle Times, they had a report over the weekend on what a traditional day looked like at one particular school, View Ridge Elementary. And they're already doing this model. And this is what they say. On a recent day in a first grade classroom, 7 advanced learners sat on the floor reading silently on their iPads. Yeah, because that's definitely a great move. That's the talk about giving them the personal touch. You know what we learned during COVID? Putting kids in front of screens really helps them learn, especially the smart kids who actually lost their educational ability at a higher rate than the normies. So let's just double down on that. That makes sense. Then they say several others wrote independently at their desks. A special education student wrote with a paraprofessional aide at their side. The rest of the class sat in a front corner of the classroom while the teacher read a book out loud. So let me get this straight. You've got some kids reading on an iPad, other kids who are writing while the teacher is telling a story, everybody poops to the class. That's what we're doing. Well, they're first graders. Whatever they read for first graders. The Giver or The Given? The Giving?
I read that. What was that? That was like, I didn't read that till like sixth grade.
Well, because they killed babies in that book.
Yeah, it was pretty dark.
I remember getting really, really traumatized by that book, but I must have been in high school when I read it. But that, does this sound workable to anybody? You're not giving any more funding. And remember, they're in a hole to what, $110 million, the budget hole? So you're not giving them any more support from a financial perspective or training. No additional training or very limited additional training with 30 kids in the class. Tell me how this works. Seriously, tell me how you're not screwing everybody. Every kid gets hurt here. And here's why. What is the philosophy from radicals? Not Democrats, but radicals. They get upset when white kids are doing too well or perceived to be doing too well. Now, if I'm that person who looks at this and says, hey, we only have X percent of Hispanic or black students doing well enough to get here, the first thing I think of is, well, how do we change that? How do we get those kids to do just as well as the white and Asian kids? Radicals say, well, that's not fair. Let's bring those white and Asian students down so everyone is equally screwed. That's equality. That's an equitable solution to these people. Tell me how that makes sense. And tell me how that serves anyone, including the normies and the kid who's got special education needs. Because now you're sticking them with a bunch of students who they don't identify with academically. And you're having like 3 or 4 different lessons going on at once, in which you kind of give some students personalized attention when you're reading a book to them. By the way, why are the kids on the iPad reading and the rest of the kids, are they that dumb? They can't read out of the books themselves? Why can't everyone just read together? Oh, they're different kinds of books that they're reading. It's almost like you're making an argument why we should put the people in a separate class who are reading a separate book at a separate level. Weird, I know. It's lazy. This is lazy. And it is the literal white knight progressives who come to the rescue. We're helping everyone. You're not helping anyone. You're telling us you're helping people, but you're not. They avoid any of the real heavy lifting here. Because I'm sure that you could find, if you did the work, legitimate barriers to diversity. But instead of actually finding them, you just say, well, systemic racism. And then that's it. You feel like you've done your job. Well, if there's systemic racism, could you maybe then truly dismantle it? You talk about dismantling systems of oppression all the time. But now they just say, well, they exist. So let's, you know, take away any of the privileges for the white and Asian students. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. But they don't want to work that hard. They just want to give the appearance that they care deeply about your kids, black and brown students, which just seems so demeaning. Black and brown. How about we just look at students and say, here are low performers. Let's work really, really hard to get them to do better. But God forbid we do that. And by the way, these folks try to have it both ways. And it never really makes any sense because on the one hand, they say, look, we have systemic racism. It's failing students of color. It's giving them a substandard education as compared to the white students who benefit more, and Asians, of course. Look at the black communities. They're not getting the same amount of funding. And they say that as a way to excuse or explain away lower test scores for black and Hispanic students. They do that, correct? Are we all on the same page?
I think so.
Okay. Now, also at the exact same time, what are they saying? Well, there are not enough people who are Black and Latino getting into the gifted programs because of systemic racism that's not identifying them. They're not being identified as gifted because of the racism that's involved. Okay, pick a lane. You can't have both lanes. You can't tell me that these kids are getting a substandard education, which implies they're not gifted because they're not getting the education that they deserve. But then also tell me, well, they are really, really bright, but the systemic racism is keeping them from being identified and then put into the gifted program. Those are two conflicting statements. Those are two conflicting statements. And there's also this implication that somehow, because you have, say, 15% Black students in the school district at a time, that you should have about 15% Black students in the gifted program. Why? What is it? Huh? Where did that come from? Everything's supposed to be equal? Is that how life works? I didn't realize that. But life doesn't quite work that way. Is it possible, given the fact that you're all already saying that Black students are not getting a good education, that when you look at the numbers, they actually are an accurate reflection of kids who would be deemed, quote unquote, gifted? Is it possible? You're not supposed to say that. You're not supposed to say, well, then maybe just right now, 3.6% of the students who took the test who happen to be Black aren't considered, quote unquote, gifted. Is that possible? You're the ones telling us it is possible. Not even possible. You're telling us it's likely. And yet here, it's because we haven't properly identified the Black students who would be gifted. Now, why is that? Is there something that you could be doing to change that? One reasonable thing, and they pointed this out at the time as a problem, you've got the tests that determine whether or not you're gifted taking place on a weekend. And not everyone has a reasonable way to transport their kid on a weekend. Okay, do it on a weekday. Well, not everyone ends up getting tested. Okay, test everyone. Oh, it's now state law to test everyone multiple times a year? Okay, great. You just addressed one of the big issues. And of course, ironically, they talk about, we're addressing inequities. Okay, how about this as an inequity? If you're a parent of means, you're going to pull your kid from these schools and put them in a private school where they're going to get a more individualized education. Oh, wait, what? The reason why they're in a budget deficit is because of how many kids ended up getting pulled from schools? Could this be playing a little bit of a role? Just a little tiny bit that parents are saying, well, you know what? Why am I dealing with this? My kid's gifted. I can afford it. I'll put them in a private school, which actually cares about them. And then what happens? Oh, yes, the school district ends up losing funds. Because when the kid goes, the funding goes. Other than that, I think this was a brilliant move, and I'm very grateful for Seattle Public Schools doing what it is they did. I've got this written up over at ktth.com. I hope you'll give it some eyeballs. I'll be talking about this on Laura Ingraham's show later on this week, as well as Varney and Company. You're listening to The Jason Rancho, 1-800-465-8770 for your texts. Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show on AM 770 KTTH. Don't forget to download the KTTH smartphone app. I can give you a few reasons why you want to do that. Number one, you can take the show and the station with you wherever it is you go. Number two, I get bonus based on how many people download the app, so you should definitely do it during my show. But number three, you'll be able to watch us perform the show. You can listen to us or you can watch the video stream live from the studio. And it's a lot of fun. I just gave a dirty look towards the camera. That's the face that I usually give when someone screws up around me. And you would only get to see that, witness that, if you were on the app. Or you can also stream us over at ktth.com. So I kind of like this idea that Brian Kilmeade put out on Fox and Friends this week. They're talking about Donald Trump and the fact that he's obviously going to be spending a lot of time in courtrooms over the course of the next several weeks going into the presidential election, which is precisely how Democrats wanted this to unfold. And that means he's spending less time out on the campaign trail. He's not doing as many speeches. So how do you get people talking about what his next presidency might look like? Brian's idea is awesome.
The president says he's gaining in some of the battleground states. He's got more money. There's no question right now than the RNC are reconfiguring, as well as the president. He's got to be spending a little bit on his court cases, can't get out as much as he can. That's why I think the president should name his whole cabinet.
Yeah.
And I would put them out everywhere to talk about what the Secretary of Labor, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense would be doing and say, this is your government. Yeah. Because the president now in April is going to be stuck in a courtroom for, they say, 6 weeks.
I kind of love that idea. I really do. I don't know if they're doing the vetting at this point. I imagine it's probably underway for a lot of these positions, but I kind of love the idea. I like the idea of telling us who a VP is going to be earlier than the conventions. Why do we have to wait? This is already prolonged. This is the longest presidential campaign in history. Just come out and give us all those details, because you know what? Depending on who you pick for the Interior Secretary, it's going to decide my vote. Now, you might ask yourself, what even does the Interior Secretary do? To which I will give a knowing look or glance to my producer to Google it, because I don't know. I think they do stuff inside, right? They don't like to go outside as an interior decorator. They're like looking around the White House and saying, well, you know, let's just be honest, Mr. President. Do these drapes really bring out this room? Does it make the room pop? Wouldn't it do a little bit better if we went with this color? And then you turn to the Interior Secretary. You know what? That's why you stay inside and don't go outside.
I don't think that's what they do.
You know, you're such a bummer. You're such a downer. What do you know? You think you're all so smart. Oh, I know what the Interior does. What does the Secretary of Interior do? You're having trouble even finding it on Google.
It says that the Department of Interior manages public lands and minerals, national parks, and wildlife.
It's improperly labeled. You can't be in charge of interior and then be focused on public land outside. That doesn't make sense. Give that job to the EPA. Stick to what you know. Interior design. And it's almost always a man, and I kind of like what that says. They're breaking barriers. Because usually say, we need to get, if it's a man, a gay man, or we have to get a woman. No, I like this. We don't play into the gender stereotypes here. Yeah, you got that right. Put that down in the book of knowledge. You're going to get the colors wrong again. Yeah, I'm not even going to try. Maybe we should stop color coding our files and just put titles on them.
That would be helpful.
Yeah, I like the colors. I like the colors. Meanwhile, more concern coming from the Biden campaign, from Democrats about RFK. He is very clearly a threat. When you look at the polls and there are 3, 4, 5-way races, it very clearly and obviously takes votes away from Joe Biden. All of the polls say that. If he's pulling votes from Trump, it's very, very small and it's not showing up on the polls. And that's why you now even have the sister coming out, making the rounds on MSNBC, pretending like it's pulling teeth to get her on TV. I don't really want to do this, but, you know, my brother shouldn't run. I hate him.
You know, the truth is that I love my brother.
Do you really? Because I would argue if you truly loved him, you would shut up if you had any doubts. What happened to just back family? What happened to that?
And it pains me to come out against him, but I am very concerned with the stakes in this election. And I'm very concerned from the polls that I'm seeing that he takes many more votes from Biden than he does from Trump.
That's why I'm a huge fan of his. I love it. Now, who could think any kind of Kennedy would actually have a shot enough to win that they would vote for that person? Someone who realizes he's going to lose, however, they like the message that it sends because they are sick and tired. You know, some people say, I don't like the two-party system. That has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with the two-party system. It has everything to do with the fact that they're just not inspired by any of the two main candidates. That's it. That's all that this is about. And he's going to stay in it, knowing very clearly what role he's playing here. He's spoiler. He's Ralph Nader. He's Jill Stein. He's Ross Perot. He knows that. And perhaps maybe that's why the White House isn't giving him Secret Service.
Denying me Secret Service protection. That's never happened in history.
You think he's behind that? Do you think Joe Biden is behind?
Of course he is. Does he know that your dad was assassinated?
No.
He has a bust.
Honestly, he probably forgot.
My father behind him at the
Oval. So how does he sleep at night?
Well, I don't know, but it's not. It's just not right.
Well, I mean, when you go to bed at 4:30 after dinner, you probably wake up in the night. So that would, Brian, come on, man. That was not a good question. So this seems really petty that he doesn't have Secret Service protection. He's clearly a candidate pulling more than like a couple percentage points, even in the general. Let's give him protection. That makes total sense to me. 1-800-465-8774, your text messages. You are listening to The Jason Rant Show.